Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. And I'm Michelle Masurgeon.
And I am Eileen Javier. We first highlight Carmen Coach Carmen Duncan of Mission Accomplished Transition Services of Schenectady with Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Melissa Brownlee.
Then RPI student Varenya Gade discusses taking classes online while living in India and how the pandemic has been handled there with HMM correspondent Carson Ray.
And then up next on a new episode of Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics, Dr. Borton speaks about the comet NEOWISE with HMM correspondent Megan Maroon.
After that, we hear episode 6 of People Science with Dr. Raquel Velho, Assistant Professor in Science and Technology Studies at Rensselaer Polytech Institute with Aaron Blanding for Nature Lab.
Finally, HMM producer Anna Stentelkamp speaks with Lee Perry and Clayton Lewis Ferrara of the United Nations accredited NGO Ideas for Us. And now some headlines.
Governor Cuomo has signed a bill granting a one-year extension to the Child Victims Act's look-back window, allowing survivors of all ages to file previously time-barred claims against their alleged abusers. The extension was granted due to the COVID-19 crisis.
The Times Union reports that two people were shot in the Mount Pleasant neighborhood in Schenectady on Monday night. The shootings were about half a mile from where a woman was shot and killed on Sunday.
Schools in New York submitted their reopening plans to the state on July 31st, but none of the plans can be implemented until several financial and regulatory roadblocks are cleared. The Times Union notes that districts must get a handle on what percentage of students and staff would actually return to the classroom, what percentage would be fully remote, and how many students could participate in a hybrid program. In addition, for an average-sized district, reopening comes with a $1.8 million price tag. Proposals largely prioritize the needs of younger children, students with special needs, and English language learners for in-person instruction.
Governor Cuomo on Monday signed a bill banning the importation of hazardous fracking waste into New York. Peter Lwanowski, the executive director of Environmental Advocates of New York, says the bill will close a long-standing loophole 4 years after PFOA and PFOS were found to have contaminated the water supply in Hoosick Falls. A state advisory committee has recommended that the state adopt a limit of 10 parts per trillion, one of the most stringent standards in the country. State officials estimate up to a quarter of public water wells in the state may eventually need to be treated.
Negotiations continue at the state's nation's capital over a COVID-19 relief package. A key issue is a $600 a week additional unemployment benefit, which expired at the end of July. Democrats are also seeking $1 billion in relief for state and local governments. The number of confirmed COVID-19 deaths is now in excess of 150,000. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Media Sanctuary, and on Facebook at facebook.com/Media Sanctuary.
Up next, Carmen quote, Coach Carmen, unquote, Duncan founded Mission Accomplished Transition Services in 2012. In this interview, she speaks with correspondent Melissa Bromley about their work on the Hillside Crossing development in Schenectady's Hamilton Hill neighborhood and why people should come to their virtual community update on Thursday, August 6. You can register to attend on their website at matransitionservices.org.
How would you introduce yourself?
Coach Carmen, Chief Coach and Founder of Mission Accomplished Transition Services.
And what is Mission Accomplished Transition Services?
Mission Accomplished is a career education organization that provides mentorship, coaching, and sponsorship services for individuals between the ages of 13 to 35 who are seeking to pursue or advance a career in construction, fashion, event planning, or as social entrepreneurs.
That's so interesting. Why that age group?
Well, when it comes to our high school students, they are in this very unique place in their life. They're in a place where people are saying, like, you know, you're growing up and you're getting more responsibility. And what's your vision for the future? And where do you see yourself? And then moving on to the 18 to 35 age group, during that time of your life, you're starting to network more within the professional world. You're starting to really understand the marriage between who you know and what you know. And you're really going through that exploration stage of what is it that you that I really want to do in a particular industry. We really feel that that age group, you know, 13 to 35, you're really exploring the world and finding your place and putting all the puzzle pieces together, but also still very comfortable with moving those puzzle pieces around.
You mentioned construction, and I know that you have this upcoming event, a community update on the Hillside Crossing community. Can you talk about what the Hillside Crossing community is?
The Hillside Crossing development is an affordable housing residential, or our affordable housing residential unit that is in the Hamilton Hill community of Schenectady, New York.
And what's the update that you're hosting?
The community update is an opportunity for the construction initiative team through Mission Accomplished to share about the partnership we have with the community builders to execute the construction career and business development program, which is a program that assists individuals who are seeking to become employed to help build the residential units and identifying and recruiting businesses, specifically businesses that are led by people of color and women and veterans, to be subcontractors on the Hillside Crossing development.
So it sounds like it is a community development project that is working to provide skills and employment to people who live within the neighborhood in which it's being built.
And some people, it's not so much providing skills, it's more just employment. So there are individuals who live in a community, they've been doing construction their whole life or just got into construction, may have participated in a program locally. So, you know, there are individuals who are skilled and they're looking for employment. And then we have individuals who are just being introduced to the industry.
What stage in the process of development is the project currently in?
We're very close to the end. The development is expected to be completed in April of 2021.
What are you hoping that people will get from the update?
Our goal is to make sure that people know what is happening with the workforce development component, the business development component, and the community engagement component.
Who are you hoping will attend?
Definitely individuals from the city of Schenectady, because it's so important that people know what's going on in their neighborhood, you know, and for us to get some feedback and some direction on what we need to do next. Like, that's something that's really, 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 really important to us, because our connections have been very heavy in Albany. Yes, a lot of times community work is similar no matter where you go, but sometimes it's not. And it, like, you really have to connect with individuals who live and work and play in the areas that you're working in. And we need to connect with the people who live, work, and play in the Hamilton Hill community so that we are communicating with people in the way that they want us to. And there may be some areas where it's just like, this is how we do things, and there's not much flexibility there. And then there's other areas where it's like, this is how we've been doing things, but it doesn't work here. And you've been very clear on that. So we're going to change the way that we do things here in Schenectady. But definitely, you know, elected officials, residents of the Hamilton Hill community, individuals who work in work in Schenectady, young adults who are totally married to Schenectady County or, you know, married to the Capital Region, but most of their work is in Schenectady. And anyone that's really committed to genuinely supporting the Hamilton Hill community. No badge of honor type of situation. Like, you're genuine about wanting to be a part of the community and helping. Helping, supporting, and listening.
Working at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in North Troy, at this time, it's been a challenge to connect with people. And we've been doing a lot of virtual online stuff as well. I wonder if you have any concerns about, you know, whether people, it's as accessible for people to be logging on to a virtual workshop like this, or if there are other ways that you guys are trying to connect with communities that we can learn from.
The door-to-door and being in PPE is one of the most impactful. And it's, although people will not get the full presentation, it's the fact of the matter that we're still, that we're following up. Like, we had this event, you may not have been able to, you know, did you participate? If the answer is no, well, this is what the focus is. Do you want to have a, can you have a conversation about this right now? I know I'm just knocking on your door and you might be doing a thing, but is it possible for us to have a conversation for a moment? And so street outreach is something that we engage in a lot.
Where can people who are listening who want to take part go to learn more, to sign up?
If you go to our website, which is matransitionservices.org, click on the events menu at the top and you will see community update. You click there and you will be able to register through Eventbrite.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you'd like to speak to?
Construction is an industry that I encourage people, Black people and people of color, to explore so that we are able to take ownership of some of the abandoned buildings and communities, and we can renovate them ourselves. And we can also show the younger youth that they have the power to do that, and that being a tradesman or a tradeswoman offers meaningful careers that allows individuals to change the way that buildings look, change the way that bridges look, help people with having the electricity that they need, the plumbing system that they need, or if someone decides that they want to do interior design, you can have total control of the way that the inside of a community space looks. If you decide you want to be an architect, like, you're drawing out the plan of what a building would look like. But, you know, and I know that interior design and architecture are very specialized careers, but they're not careers that are talked about as an opportunity. And also with construction, there are 14 different trade unions here that can educate you about the variety of careers, from painting walls to putting tape on walls to prepare for the painters, to masons, which are individuals who are working with cement and marble and other types of stone. And we all walk into buildings every day. There are people who built those buildings. There are people that painted those walls, the chairs that we, you know, that, or the tables that we use. They were constructed by carpenters. We don't, like, these are exciting careers, and we need to understand that they are meaningful. And you get a pension. You can get a pension if you're a part of a union. And health insurance, you know, all the other perks that people rave about with some of these mainstream careers that seem to be more prestigious. I encourage anyone who's listening to me right now to look at construction jobs as an opportunity to pursue, an opportunity to support and uplift and not look down on.
That was Asia Mem correspondent Melissa Brownlee speaking with Carmen Duncan, founder of Mission Accomplished Transition Services.
Next, RPI student Varenya Gade discusses taking classes online while living in India and how the pandemic has been handled there with HMM correspondent Carson Ray.
Hello, today with The Sanctuary, we are talking to Varenya Gade, who is an RPI student who has spent the last couple of years living in India. First off, I like to just ask, are you planning to return to campus in the fall?
Just last night, I decided not to return to campus in the fall, but it's less to do with the entire pandemic and more because passport offices are closed. And that means that my passport won't be able to be renewed in time. So I won't be returning to campus in the fall.
Will you be doing online classes then?
Yeah, I'm trying to get all of my classes online.
How does that work with the time difference?
I won't lie. It's kind of tough. I have a lot of classes that go till 3:30 a.m., but I try to plan my schedule so that my sleep schedule isn't as bad as it could be. And my family's pretty supportive and very helpful with it, so it works out.
Has the school offered you any support in this way?
So for all of their students, they've tried to have exams, like for my classes anyway. My exams are stretched over a 24-hour period, and I can take them at any point in that at that time, so I can take it during the day for me. And all of my lectures are recorded, so I, like, unless I absolutely have to be there, most of the time I can just listen to the recordings later.
That's good. So you are a U.S. citizen, but I'm sure you've heard about the deportation of international students who are taking online classes. That luckily was struck down, but do you have any thoughts on the reasoning behind that?
I have a few theories of why that might have been done, but and as to the effect I've seen, it's been pretty bad. Like, I have a lot of cousins that aren't American citizens and who have come back to India. And the issue, what happened was those that were still in India, that were still in America and couldn't come back to their home countries because of travel laws and such and had only online classes, they had no idea what to do. And students that were here already and their universities that were trying to give even one class in person for students that were there, that meant that their system was hybrid, which means they had to either come back to America or lose their visa. It was honestly like being stuck between a rock and a hard place. They felt very trapped. And I'm not sure what the reasoning for that could have been, but I think part of it might just have to do with hurrying up the reopening plan for the country at large. And international students and universities, they're a really big part of that. So I think that might have been why it came into force. And I'm really glad it was struck down because there's a lot that like people don't consider when trying to find a solution to that. There were a lot of petitions going around talking about how we could have at least one class in person for international students that were stuck in America, but the impact of international students that would have on international students that managed to make it back home wasn't something that was really considered.
Have you had any thoughts on coming back to America?
So while my major reason for not returning in the fall will be because of my passport, I did have a lot of misgivings just because even the best laid plans for how to keep people safe and healthy, especially in colleges, those do tend to fall apart. Like, for example, during flu season, one person gets sick, everyone gets sick. Colleges just tend to be like that kind of community where everyone is surrounded by other people. And if you're not surrounded by other people, you do feel really lonely, and it's really hard to deal with that. Which is why I was considering staying home, even though the time difference makes things hard. At least here, I'd be surrounded by family, and I'd be in a safer environment than I would with the common dining facilities and like lecture rooms and just common living facilities.
Mm. America has sort of stopped reporting on what's happening in other countries. How are things going in India?
So it was a pretty big deal in March, I guess. India went into complete lockdown for a few months. They just, like, no one was allowed out. All businesses were shut down. It was an entire thing. And if for some reason that did not even begin to slow down the rate of infection. And now when everything's opening up again, things are just worse than they were before. So if anything, the rate is just rocketing. And it's, I think India's right now has the third most COVID cases in the world. And yeah, it's not great. It's not a great situation to be in. But I think what did happen was the initial lockdown period did give our healthcare system a chance to brace itself and to bring in the equipment and supplies it would need to deal with a crisis of this magnitude. And also, there are antivirals around that are definitely doing more of an impact. Which is why, while there are a lot of people being infected, something that people have noticed is that the death rate in India, the death toll seems to have gone down a lot, which might be because of how late in the crisis the pandemic hit the country.
Here it tends to be almost a political opinion. People see the virus. What are people's opinions of it in India?
India is, I will say, a developing country to the state. Which means people don't tend to, well, okay, that is not true. People do tend to politicize things as much as anywhere else. But what does happen is there's almost a fanatical belief in the government to the extent where the lockdown, like when people are expected to just stay in their houses for two to three months and nothing was open and no one was allowed outside and there was an entire curfew, people still followed it. There is a tendency to, I personally believe that there's a tendency to panic here a lot. And that mass panic, if anything, it has turned the virus into more of a monster than it is, less than like, and debating its existence is completely out of the question, I'd say.
You said you have cousins who were studying in the States through visas. Do you know they plan to do?
So they're back in India right now. And when the policy came out at first, they were very disturbed by it. But now with them being allowed to take online classes, I don't think anyone's coming back to university just because of like the dangers of international travel right now. It's very scary. And there is no real way to keep you safe for that. It's almost a 30-hour flight. Like a 30-hour journey, and a direct flight would be less time, but usually it takes 30 hours with layovers and everything, and yeah, it is very daunting. And there is also the worry that once they get back to college, universities will go back online, which is seeming more and more likely by the day with rates not slowing down. And if that does happen and travel restrictions are clamped down again, that would mean that they'd be stranded. And I don't think that's something anyone's willing to risk, really.
Yeah. How do you think RPI specifically has done with handling everything?
I will say that RPI took the pandemic seriously pretty early on. However, and right now, some of their policies are they're very strict. Some say to the point of being too strict. For example, there is this policy that even people that live off campus, they need a specific bathroom ratio to the number of residents. And if they do not fulfill that bathroom ratio, I think it's 2:1, they won't be allowed on campus. And stuff like that has made the number of people actually going to be on campus very low. They claim to be testing very regularly and to be sanitizing very regularly. I won't say they've been very forthcoming with information, but they do seem to have a plan in place.
That's good. Before we end, is there anything you'd like to touch on?
I just think that with all the precautions colleges can be taking right now, and I know how important it is that colleges return to their normal functioning, I still think it is important for them to maybe keep most of their functions online right now, because even with the best of intentions and the best of healthcare policies, colleges can be, I will say, cesspools for infection. And it's a very dangerous time. And I think people should keep that in mind, especially on campus, like, you know, follow the rules and maybe try to stay to yourself as much as possible.
Sounds good. Well, thank you so much for talking with us today. This has been great.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
We just heard RPI student Varinia Gade with HMM correspondent Carson Ray. For those just tuning in, I am Eileen.
And I'm Michelle. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org or get in touch with us through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
Physicist and solar boat builder David Borton is back. Dr. Borton describes the comet Neowise and the difference between comets and meteors on a new episode of Equality Under the Law of Practical Physics. He and WOOC correspondent Megan Marone discuss how to discern the difference between comets and meteors in the night sky, why the moons of Jupiter create a glowing straight line in the night sky, and how to socially distance with a canoe paddle.
Yes, it is rocket science on your end. Yes, it is.
Hi, Dr. Borton.
Hi, Megan. Talking to your phone on a canoe paddle here, passing it back and forth. We're at least 6 feet apart. Good to see you. You're looking well. It's been a long, long time since we've talked.
Yes, and so the audience out there, if our responses are a little spaced apart, it's because it takes, you know, a good 2 seconds to pass this canoe paddle back and forth. But, you know, I tend to think of scientists as innovative.
Well, you've been innovating your way around the country. You've been all over since I saw you last. You want to tell people where you've been?
Oh my goodness. Yes, it involved a lot of quarantining and a lot of care. So just to say that it wasn't a reckless tour, but I was quarantined in Olympia, Washington. And then after that, I went to Seattle and I did a couple socially distanced interviews with Black Lives Matter protesters at CHOP. First it was CHAZ, Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. Then drove to get home to family and to quarantine back in New York, drove across the country, and on my way from a distance I saw the mountains of Wyoming and Yellowstone, and then broke up the trip by staying with a friend, a scientist, Danielle, in Minneapolis. And in Minneapolis, saw the occupation of the 5-block radius around where George Floyd died, and was really inspired by all of the indigenous presence there, that the American Indian Movement had set up presence to show solidarity with Black Lives Matter. The yurts said this yurt was at Standing Rock, so showing the continuum between all of these movements. And the movements are essentially all about the right for people to breathe, to live.
Well, that's very interesting. I didn't know you did all that. Good work for you. One of the things that occurs to me is that at least at some point in human history, people thought that when big change was happening, comets would be portending things like that. And we happen to have one of those in the vicinity right now.
Yeah, I keep hearing about this comet and I keep getting news from people to look up at the night sky, but I know very little about the comet and I know very little about how to see it in the sky. So for our listenership, is there any way that you can describe the comet itself, why this is a special astronomical event, and how we could see it in upstate New York?
Wow, that's a lot. Okay, the universe is mostly hydrogen. And hydrogen is a gas, and as a gas, it's hard to keep it in one place. But when hydrogen combines with oxygen, it makes what?
H2O water.
Exactly. And water has this wonderful, water has a whole bunch of wonderful properties. And one of which is that it makes this nice solid stuff called ice when it's cold. And most of space is cold. And so it's not hard to understand how ice forms in space, just like ice forms in hail and snowflakes. And so this ice makes a ball, and pretty soon the ball gets big enough so that gravity keeps it together. And one of these gravity balls got knocked out of wherever it was circling the sun and changed its orbit so that its orbit came closer to the sun and to our Earth. And that's a comet.
So could you, if it's simple and not too complex for everyone, what is the gravitational pull around the sun with this, I'll, in my imagination, think of it as a snowball hydrogen packed thing?
The easiest way to think about that is to go out, and now is a good time on a clear night, and look at Jupiter. Jupiter rises about 9:30 or 10 o'clock in the southeast, and it goes to the south. And so if you go out, you know, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock on a clear night with binoculars, you can not only see Jupiter, you can see the four moons of Jupiter. And the four moons of Jupiter are either on one side or the other side, and they move back and forth across where you see Jupiter. And that's because the moons, like our moon, is held in a circle around the Earth. The moons of Jupiter are held in a circle around Jupiter. And as you look at the edge of the circle, you don't see the round part. You just see the moons going back and forth across the face of Jupiter. And so that's pretty cool. And that's the way gravity works.
What do you mean you don't see the round part?
Okay, so think of a circle of any kind, the lid of a can. If you look at it straight on, you see a circle. But if you turn the can so that you're looking across the circle, you see just a line instead of the circle. And that's what you see for the moons, because they're going around and around Jupiter, but that's just a back and cross if you're looking from the side.
So you just don't see their full spherical shape?
Yes, you don't see that they're a circle, you just see that they're a line moving back and forth. So gravity is this wonderful force. We think of it as pretty big, but it's small compared to the electrical force that gives us our strength and our muscles and our brains and all that stuff. But this force is big enough to hold things like comets together. Not a great big force, but if you're out where there's not a lot of gravity, because gravity falls off with the inverse square of distance, meaning if you go twice as far, there's one-fourth as much gravity. But gravity is strong enough to hold this comet in an orbit around the sun. And that orbit brings it closer to Earth. In fact, on the 22nd, I think it was the 22nd, it was the closest to Earth in its orbit around the sun. And what do we know about the sun?
You like it so much.
And what particularly part do I like?
The way that your solar boats just get powered by that puppy.
Right, solar energy. So solar energy keeps our whole planet alive, but solar energy is hitting this comet all the time. And so if you think of a little snowball out in space and you think of the sun's rays shining on it, the sun does a couple of things. It knocks some of the comet apart, and that becomes dust and dirt behind the comet, and that's a tail. And it also ionizes some of the gases that are associated with that, probably particularly hydrogen, and that's ionized. And the ionized gas behaves differently in sunlight than the dust. So the comet actually has two tails.
Interesting. Can we see with the naked eye the distinction between those two tails?
Okay, I've seen the comet with my naked eye and even with binoculars. And with binoculars, they weren't powerful enough to see the two tails. There are pictures from telescopes that show the two tails, but I only saw one tail. But it was a very long white streak of light in the night. And then at the bottom of this streak, which is the head of the comet, there's this bigger white fuzzy thing, which is the sunlight reflecting off the comet and all the stuff coming off from the comet.
So is there, could you delineate the difference for us between a comet and a meteor?
Okay, so meteors, we talked about the tail of the comet being this dust tail. Well, that dust tail sometimes is usually left in space, and sometimes the Earth's orbit brings the Earth into this dust tail. And the dust tail then has these small particles in it, and those small particles become meteors that we see in the night. So that we're coming up on a meteor shower in August, and that's from a comet that went by. And I'm sorry, I can't remember which comet provided the meteors for August.
You're referring to the Leonids, though, right?
Ah, that sounds right.
Yes. Oh, yes. Do you need me to teach you something about science, Dr. Port?
There's so much I don't know. Yeah, please.
We are in strange times.
Please teach me lots. I never really studied astronomy, except that I love to be outdoors and watch for meteors at night, look at the comet. And now there's these strange things that are artificial man-made satellites that go overhead at night. So you see those things. For me, it was a thrill to see Sputnik when it first went up. That was pretty amazing. But now there are just too many satellites up there, and I'm not sure we need them all.
That was Dr. Borton on a new episode of Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics, with HMM correspondent Megan Maroon.
Episode 6 of People's Science features Dr. Raquel Belho, Assistant Professor in Science and Technology Studies at Rensselaer Polytech Institute. People's Science interviews researchers and scientists of color from a variety of disciplines about the importance of their work and how systems of inequality have impacted their fields through a lens of social and environmental justice, especially considering the racial justice movement happening today. Hosted by Hudson Mohawk Magazine producer Erin Blanding for Nature Lab.
This is Erin Blanding, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Raquel Belho. To get started, we could just talk about your research and possibly what impact you hope your work has on your field.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I'm a sociologist of technology. I do research on disabled users on how they access public transit. That was the way that I kind of started thinking about the world around me, is through the lens of infrastructures. And I became really curious about what makes an infrastructure work or not work for specific people. So the first case study that I ever embarked upon was researching how wheelchair users get around the public transport system in London. And what I thought was going to be, let's say, a relatively straightforward scenario of, well, disabled people just can't use public transport systems. What came to the front as I did the work was that wheelchair users and disabled users of infrastructures are constantly doing really intricate building work. They come up with extremely creative solutions to be able to access spaces and access networks in ways that a lot of non-disabled people would never have imagined. And at the end of the day, what has come to the front is that this type of creative, day-to-day, ad hoc problem-solving work actually impacts our infrastructures in really interesting ways and pushes them forward and molds them in new and unexpected ways. And when I started doing this work, I guess I didn't really know what I wanted to get out of it besides my PhD, perhaps. And slowly it started becoming clear that working on this intersection of the field called science and technology studies and disability studies, is a really liberatory space to work in because I get to speak about marginalized people and marginalized bodies and how technologies and science have worked towards marginalizing particular people and particular bodies, and also demonstrate that this isn't a sad story at all times because people are active every single day and are coming up with creative solutions for marginalization. And it's working in those interstices that really create new and exciting futures for everybody.
Wow, that's a really interesting, those are really interesting intersects to think about. And I'm wondering, you know, what impact have COVID-19 and the Black Lives Matter movement had on your research?
Yeah, so I guess a lot of different types of impact. On a more personal level, I'm Brazilian and I'm an immigrant, so most of my family is in Brazil. And partly due to that, but also partly due to professional interests, I've started thinking about my next research project in Brazil, which is going to be on the infrastructures of big science and big scientific facilities. So this summer, I was supposed to go to my new field site in Brazil and start some exploratory work. And of course, COVID has put a very quick stopper on those plans. And also when seeing my family, which has been extremely difficult for me. As far as the Black Lives Matter movement goes, it's had extraordinary impact in my day-to-day life in terms of my activism and the work that I see myself doing in letter writing and participating in protests. But I realized in the past 2 weeks that it's actually completely reshifted the plans that I had around this project on big science facilities in Brazil, and especially in the Global South. Because for the longest time, I thought that what I was going to do is just sit there and think about, oh, how are these infrastructures built and who builds them and how is their maintenance done and who does that maintenance? And as soon as I started sitting down with a lot of new literature written by Black scholars, I realized that to do that without a critical race theory lens was to not give the full picture, because Brazil, like the United States, is a country that has very clear distinctions on class and race divides around who does what types of work and what types of work are valued in society. And I think that it, with just a little bit of research, it'll be evident that these big science facilities that are often prized as being intellectual hubs of the Global South are spaces where white people get a lot of credit, but it's Black and brown bodies and Black and brown people who have built them and do the work of maintenance every single day and help these facilities continue to do the work that they're capable of doing. So that's one of the hypotheses that I've been working with, and Black Lives Matter and the Black Lives Matter movement and Black scholars have really opened my eyes to doing justice to that type of analysis as well.
Awesome. I'm wondering what excites you most about the uprising happening today?
Yeah, a lot of things excite me. So one of the insights that has come to me from my work is that it is marginalized people doing the work that craft new possibilities and new futures for everybody. And what really excites me about the movement and the uprisings right now is that it feels like for the first time people are seeing actual new futures come to the forefront and imagining them collectively. So it doesn't feel like it's just science fiction. It doesn't feel like it's Octavia Butler or Ursula Le Guin writing about different worlds, or Adrienne Marie Brown talks a lot about the need for science fiction and imagining new futures, and how the writing of science fiction is the imagining of possibilities and possible futures. And these uprisings feel like they're really big steps towards those new futures, and that excites me.
I agree. You're a researcher, and I'm wondering, based on, you know, your experience, what do you think is the first step in making STEM more welcoming to people of color?
So a big question, right? Because I teach in a polytechnic institute. I'm a professor at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and one of the things that I realize in teaching in a STEM facility, but also being a sociologist and teaching in the humanities department, is that a lot of times questions around politics and race and identity and gender and sexuality is kind of pushed into the humanities as if it were the remit of the humanities. So STEM as fields get to become weirdly, I loosely use the word protected here, from having to deal with the messiness. And one of the things that science and technology does as a field is it has lifted this veil of neutrality from the sciences and from technologies and mathematics to show that there's a lot of community work that goes into developing knowledges, and the sciences are spaces of politics as well. So I think one of the ways in making STEM more welcoming to people of color and to immigrants and to people who have been historically marginalized is to no longer pretend that we can shove these discussions only into the humanities. I think the teaching of computer science needs to be inflected with the work that computer sciences does in algorithm building as world building. We're developing very specific ways of framing the world when we develop an algorithm. And that doesn't come from the ether. That doesn't come from nowhere. That's coming from very specific social expectations and social prejudices. So to teach STEM more equitably and to have higher retention, I think, in the STEM fields is going to require a rehaul of STEM education in a way that allows for this messiness to really come into play in the fields and to contend with that messiness. Be aware that when we're teaching sciences, we are teaching often things that have come to us through racial histories of experimentations, that we are teaching things that were often researched by rich white men in the United Kingdom in a process of colonialization. And to erase that history is to do that science a disservice.
I'm very excited to see where all these conversations push us. So I appreciate you joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Erin.
Awesome. So this has been Erin Blanding, and I spoke with Dr. Raquel Felio for People Science, and thanks for tuning in.
We just heard Dr. Raquel Felio, Assistant Professor in Science and Technology Studies at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, with HMM correspondent Erin Blanding for Nature Lab.
Up next, HMM producer Anna Stettenkamp speaks with Lee Perry, the Chief Operations Officer, and Clayton Lewis Ferrara, the Executive Director of the United Nations accredited NGO Ideas for Us, which is an Orlando-based grassroots nonprofit organization that creates global environmental solutions within the five pillars of sustainability: energy, water, food, waste, and ecology, through local action. Since 2008, Ideas for Us has taken action in 30 countries worldwide.
Will you begin by introducing yourselves, including your roles at the organization Ideas for Us?
My name is Lee Perry, and I'm the Chief Operations Officer of Ideas for Us.
I'm Clayton Lewis Ferrara. I'm the Executive Director of Ideas for Us.
On your website, it states that your organization seeks to help people and heal the planet through education, engagement, and empowerment. Can you expand on the importance of this threefold approach and why each aspect is necessary?
Well, you can't know that a problem is worth fixing if you've never heard of the problem. And if you're in a situation where you're a climate change refugee, or, you know, you live in a very remote village, being able to mobilize volunteers globally to get this education in front of people who will be on the front lines of the climate crisis is extraordinarily important. And then empowering young leaders, all different ages, but predominantly our youth, because they're the ones that are seeing their future being really affected by climate change. But empowering individuals to, you know, have the tools and the know-how and understanding how to, you know, strategize, because it might seem to some people very obvious how to get people to come out and engage, but communities are very diverse. Not everyone is as connected as we'd like them to be in this day of technology, you know, so there are different strategies that we help these leaders globally understand so that they can have so many different ways to get their community to come on board and be a part of the movement. How to think outside the box, how to understand that bringing partners to the table is the only way that we can expand our reach so that we can get the most amount of people to take part in this movement. So, you know, empowering these individuals is also extraordinarily important as well.
Thank you. Is there anything you'd like to add, Clay?
Yeah, you know, I think being able to address these problems as well for your average person begins as an interest, right, in that educate aspect, maybe even as a hobby, right? I know that that's how it began for myself. In elementary school, I was voraciously learning about the environment and animals, and, you know, I'm a naturalist, right? So I always say that you can't be a naturalist in the 21st century and not be a conservationist, because you see everything disappearing and being destroyed. We're, after all, in the sixth great extinction. But having the ability to act on those hobbies and those interests is a luxury for a lot of people. And what would really help is if they saw a clear path from them being interested in sustainability, interested in the environment, interested in animals, and a life where that's what they do. And we need so many people to join the green workforce in what's called the third industrial revolution. We need people to install solar. We need people to install electric vehicle charging stations. We need people to help cities transition to become smart cities. We need electric meters for monitoring and adjusting electricity use for homes. These things have a huge impact on carbon emissions. We're able to cut down 30% of carbon emissions of a building just through light bulbs being transitioned to LEDs. But we need people to go in and do those kinds of benchmarks and assessments and installments and all of those kinds of things. So I think that if people realized that there's a path from educate, engage in the community, and then empower themselves to have a different career or learn more themselves or be an ecopreneur, we would solve a lot of environmental issues much quicker. So I think that that's why that kind of triple whammy is so important. And in many cases, educate, engage, and employ is what we need for the 21st century.
Thank you. Lee, I know you mentioned the five pillars of sustainability that your organization Ideas for Us focuses on, again, energy, water, food, waste, and ecology. When developing and implementing solutions, does your organization take a holistic approach, or do you typically target each pillar individually?
When it comes to what we do, I think we are trying to take a holistic approach. I mean, I try to include mental and emotional health in each focus area, because there's so many levels in everything that we're talking about. You know, when we're talking about something that has to do with, you know, water quality, I want to talk about, you know, how not having access to the cleanest water could have impacts on your cognitive abilities. You know, it may have an impact on your physical health. And of course, also the ecological health around the surrounding water quality issues that we have. There's so many layers to each focus area. So I try to, you know, break down the information so that it's digestible for people of all different backgrounds, because not everybody is able to, you know, wrap their minds around this concept, because they're just not, maybe they haven't been exposed to it. But then again, you also have people that right now the information is right at their fingertips. So there's a lot of people that are very in tune with the sustainability movement, and they want to, you know, learn more and take in as much as they can. So making everything that we teach accessible so that if people want to do more homework, we're providing sources, we're making sure that, you know, the speakers that we invite to speak at the Hive, we include their contact information so that they can connect with them and see how they can get involved with their organization or their foundation or whatever we're trying to highlight at the time. So we definitely have a very multifaceted approach to, you know, educating and organizing these environmental action projects. And it's inclusive for everyone. I feel like the fact that we try to have even meditation days out in a forest or yoga, you know, we try it to interlink that we human beings are not separate from nature, that we are one with nature. And so what we do for ourselves, we need to also do for nature. And when you are shifting your behavior, try to understand that we need to replicate something that might be naturally occurring in our world. An example of that is our diet. We're omnivores, so we are supposed to eat meat according to our evolution. But factory farming is not a natural process. Nothing else in the world pollutes as much as we do in and has an agriculture system as devastating as we do. So, you know, if people want to get on a debate about what we should eat and if we should switch over to being a vegan and what have you, every single decision that you make, you need to take into consideration what is natural and how do we leave the smallest footprint possible. And that's our approach for educating people, not to marginalize anyone and say, how dare you for eating meat, or I can't believe you have a plastic bottle in your hand, you know, shame on you. It should really be an education process from the second you open your eyes. What decisions are you making? How can you lessen your footprint? And let's all be a part of that movement together, step by step.
Thank you. Would you like to add anything, Clay?
Yeah, I think what we definitely don't need in the environmental movement right now is a whole lot of finger pointing. You know, I think that what's very important today is that with this renewed surge of social and civil justice out there, whether it's through Black Lives Matter or the housing crisis that we're now going to be facing, that evictions have begun again, and we're looking at millions of Americans potentially winding up homeless, there's an opportunity for the environment, right, to be seen as something that's an ally along with these movements and not separate from it. Eco-racism is a very real thing. And just as companies are looking at, you know, how the triple bottom line is such a new innovative way for them to think the economic, social, and environmental aspects together, I think that we're going to need to not have finger pointing. We're going to need for social and economic reform to include environmental, and that it's really only through that that our country is going to get on the right path. We're on a very destructive path where we know that if things continue the way that they are, factory farming, as Lee said, and the just continued destruction of things like rainforests and coral reefs and global fishing stocks and the continued use of pollutants that change our global climate, like fossil fuels. We know that this is not going to end well. And, you know, we're looking at 8 billion lives on this planet, and the carrying capacity of the planet is only about 3 billion. So we definitely need a transition here. Otherwise, the 21st century is not going to be rosy.
That was Asian Men producer Anna Steltenkamp speaking with Lee Perry and Clayton Lewis Ferrara of the United Nations accredited NGO Ideas for Us. This was part two of two segments. And that concludes our show. We hope you have enjoyed this episode of the Hawks on Mohawk magazine. I am Eileen.
And I'm Michelle. Our engineer is Alexis. Remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or to comment on our work, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
As a reminder, the Hawks on Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in helping without radio effort. Shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.